Welcome once again to our program, Decoding Angels and Demons. This is Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Terre Haute at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. Again, our guest and our great research person for this Decoding Angels and Demons is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. This is our fourth in a series on the popular novel and movie Angels and Demons. We've been looking at Dan Brown's novel over the past few sessions, and not only considering the content of the book, but also what's wrong with it, especially from a Catholic perspective. As with his novel, The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown makes a lot of assertions about the Catholic Church that simply aren't true. And all the while claiming, very clearly claiming, that whatever in the book is truly and researched to be true. Give us, Ron, if you could now, a little summary of the errors that many scholars have found in Angels and Demons. They're not just errors about the Catholic Church, but many other variety of errors.
That's true. And one of the reasons we're looking at some of these other types of errors is because when you have errors in one area, it's very likely that you could have errors or probably have errors in another area as well. And also, if you have errors in little matters, it's also very probable you're going to have errors in big matters, ones that really matter. Well, as I said a couple of sessions ago, one source has done a good job of categorizing the errors in the novel, so I'll use that source, which classifies the errors as follows. There's the historical errors, and we went into some of those. Errors of location in the novel, a lot of cultural errors, a lot of errors regarding art and architecture. Remember, we talked about famous painters and sculptors and architects such as Bernini and Raphael, and others that Dan Brown had made some rather erroneous statements about. Actually, all of these men were really very devout Catholics, and their work was done mainly to glorify God in some way to benefit others. A lot of errors in translation. The book is full of Latin phrases and Italian phrases and this, that, and the other. And people who are experts in languages tell us that a lot of these are not properly translated by Dan Brown. Technological errors, we looked at some of those, and then we looked at several religious errors, and then we've come to focus now on scientific errors. And a lot of the errors that we discussed might seem trivial, but if one, as I said at the beginning, can't be trusted in small matters, how can he be trusted in big ones, especially when he claims that all of his facts are accurate? The problem is, a lot of people believe Brown's false claims, especially those regarding doctrinal or historical matters about the Catholic Church. And as I said during the first session, the anti-Catholicism in the Da Vinci Code is more doctrinal in nature, whereas the main errors regarding the Church and Angels and Demons tend to be more historical in nature. And I think this is very important because the Catholic Church is an historical religion, one in which historical accuracy is crucial to faith and its credibility.
All right, nice summary of where we've come from, Ron. Let's talk a little bit now about the errors of science. We just gotten started in that category, so this is so important to our refutation of Brown's false claims about the Church. So let's start there on this session today.
The novel is full of scientific errors that one hardly knows where to even begin. Of course, many, if not most, of the errors dealing with scientific matters overlap with other categories, such as historical and religious errors. And as we started the other day and just gotten started in our last session, Brown makes the claim that CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, located near the Swiss-French border, and we talked a little bit about that in one of the earlier sessions, so I won't repeat what we said there, but that it has reproduced particles of antimatter, which is the most powerful energy source known to man. This is quoting now from Dan Brown's book, Angels and Demons. A single gram of antimatter contains the energy of a 20 kiloton nuclear bomb, the size of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, end of quote. This is something that Brown was quoting from the book.
Okay.
Well, to the contrary, Catholic Replies, that's a noted organization headed by a man, I believe his name is Drummy, and there used to be a Catholic priest affiliated with this. I think he's dead, if I recall now. But they've written quite a few books, and they have a kind of a syndicated question and answer kind of format in a lot of Catholic newspapers around the country. But and a good website, I might add, too. Catholic Replies states, quote, CERN says that it is not possible to use antimatter as an energy source, that it does not make antimatter as described in the book, and that antimatter is perfectly safe given the minute quantities we can make. It would be very dangerous if we could make a few grams of it, but this would take us billions of years. So,
wow.
You remember in the earlier sessions we were talking about how this antimatter was stolen by an assassin who had killed this Catholic priest who also happened to be a world-renowned research scholar, and that his daughter, Vittoria, she had developed some kind of way to take this little drop of antimatter that supposedly was made with this atomic collider, and put it in a canister that she had invented, and then by using some kind of different magnetic forces, it could make this little drop float right in the middle so that it wouldn't touch any matter, because if the antimatter touched the matter, it would release a tremendous amount of energy, causing a great explosion. And this is what he's saying here. It contains the energy of a 20 kiloton nuclear bomb. And, well, of course, CERN is saying here, as Catholic Replies is quoting CERN, is that it would take them a billion years to make enough, using the technology they have now to make antimatter, it would take them a billion years to make enough to, make any kind of an explosion at all.
And I want to say again on this program, to give you credit, Ron, you took the trouble to read the book, Angels and Demons, 569 pages. So when you're quoting things, that you're quoting from the book that you took the time to read.
Yeah, that'd be a good penance to give somebody after confession sometime.
Right. Well, doesn't Brown make a lot of mistakes claims about scientists, such as Copernicus and Galileo?
Yes, he does. In fact, we can conduct a series entirely on his mistakes about Galileo alone. And we're going to say quite a bit about him in the next two or three sessions. But in regard to Copernicus, he has Langdon. Remember, he's the hero, the symbologist, in the book and, of course, in the movie. And also, you might recall he'd been the hero in the Da Vinci Code as well, saying at one point that, quote, outspoken scientists like Copernicus were murdered. Murdered by the Catholic Church for revealing scientific truths. Religion has always persecuted science, end of quote. Now, Catholic Reply says in response to that, that the truth of the matter is, quote, Copernicus, who lived from 1473 to 1543, was a Polish cleric, astronomer, and a devout Catholic who theorized, contrary to conventional wisdom, that the Earth revolved around the Sun. And his theories were circulated in a manuscript entitled Six Books on the Revolutions of the Celestial Orbits, which he dedicated to Pope Paul III. And he died of natural causes in 1543. He wasn't murdered by the Catholic Church for his beliefs.
Gosh. That's a kind of startling misstatement that are so unfair, because historically it's not even true. And what a blow against the Catholic Church that Copernicus was murdered by the Catholic Church.
And unfortunately, this is the only information that some people get about the Catholic Church, even including, unfortunately, some Catholics, that comes from books like Angels and Demons and the Da Vinci Code.
Okay. You got anything else to say about Galileo?
Well, regarding Galileo, Langdon says that, quote, Galileo was an Illuminatus, end of quote. And he says elsewhere that the Illuminati were a group of men in Rome who in the 1500s fought back against the church. He states, of course, the Illuminati were hunted ruthlessly by the Catholic Church, end of quote. Well, Catholic replies, says that the truth of the matter is, quote, the Illuminati were founded in 1776, not the 1500s, and were never hunted by the Catholic Church, end of quote. Moreover, and I'm quoting here again, since Galileo died in 1642, 134 years before the founding of the Illuminati, he could not have been an Illuminatus, end of quote. Margaret Wertheim, a prominent Australian science writer and the author of books on the cultural history of physics, and really she has some very good books and articles, writes that according to Dan Brown, quote, the Galileo affair was a simple matter. Galileo had dangerous new scientific data that the church repressed. The reality is far, far more complex. As with the other inaccuracies, the truth would undoubtedly have bogged down Brown's fast-paced story. But it's important to know that while Langdon claims his, that is Galileo's data, was incontrovertible, in fact his data were not compelling, and it would take many years before experimental evidence would become pervasive. And Galileo did not know that the geocentric model of the solar system was dead wrong, as Brown claims. In another place, Brown has Langdon saying that Galileo, quote, had been arrested and almost executed by the church by proclaiming that the sun and not the earth was the center of the solar system. So the church tried Galileo as a heretic, found him guilty, and put him under the permanent house arrest, end of quote. Well, as Catholic Replies points out, the truth is, quote, actually three popes honored the Italian astronomer between the years 1564 and 1642 for his scientific work. But in 1616, Pope Paul V ordered Galileo to stop teaching the theory that the sun was the center of the solar system because he thought that it contradicted the Bible. Galileo agreed not to promote the doctrines, but in 1632 he wrote a book defending it, and he was tried in 1633 before the Holy Office, which found him, quote, vehemently suspected of heresy, and sentenced him to house arrest. There never was a threat of execution, and Galileo's confinement was comfortable and sometimes luxurious. When he was dying, he received a special blessing from Pope Urban VIII, who had been a friend of his, a personal friend of his.
Okay. Well, let's focus a little bit then on the Galileo affair, since it's always, always brought up against the Catholic Church as one of the clear signs that the church is against science and will repress in any way it can anything that the church in any way doesn't agree with.
Yeah, the other two things are primarily the Crusades and the Inquisition.
Okay.
And I could name a couple of others. Today, of course, the Holocaust has gotten to be a big one in the 20th century. A lot of false claims have been made about Pius XII and the Catholic Church.
And yet an awful lot Jewish sources.
And we can make a whole sort, you know, a whole series.
Come out defending Pius XII.
Yeah, there have been a lot of books, a lot of articles, and we can make a series very easily on that. Maybe sometime we will.
All right, good. Well, tell us some more about the controversy of Galileo and the church.
Well, there have been many books and articles written about this subject, both pro and con, especially over the past several years. In fact, we could easily conduct a series just on this subject alone. Catholic Answers states that, quote, this is another organization within the Catholic Church that has a question and answer format. They have a website. They have books that they put out. You know, trying to defend the church against all kinds of accusations, false accusations. Quote, it is commonly believed that the Catholic Church persecuted Galileo for abandoning the geocentric or earth as the center view of the solar system for the heliocentric, that is, the sun at the center view. The Galileo case for many anti-Catholics is thought to prove that the church abhors science, refuses to abandon outdated teachings, and is not infallible. For Catholics, the episode is often an embarrassment, end of quote. Dan Brown makes considerable use of the Galileo case in his attempt to undermine or discredit the Catholic Church in Angels and Demons. The Catholic Replies that we've quoted several times says that, Quote, according to Brown, the Illuminati, which numbered Galileo amongst its members, was founded to assert the superiority of science over the irrationality of religion, especially Roman Catholicism, end of quote. To rebut this, Catholic Reply states, quote, the church is not anti-scientific. It has supported scientific endeavors for centuries. During Galileo's time, the Jesuits had a highly respected group of astronomers and scientists in Rome. In addition, many notable scientists received encouragement and funding from the church and from individual church officials. Many of the scientific advances during this period were made either by clerics or as a result of church funding, end of quote. We'll say quite a bit about this assertion in another series that I've been working on that has to do with the Catholic contribution to building Western civilization, which would include science and architecture and art and law and all kinds of subjects like that.
Okay, hasn't this Galileo affair been one of the main issues used by anti-Catholics against the church down through history?
Yes, it has, together with what I mentioned a while ago, the Crusades and the Inquisition. Resorting to the facts of history, one can easily refute all of these criticisms of the church. Regarding Galileo, George Sim Johnson writes in an article, quote, The Galileo Affair, end of quote, that's the name of the article. The most striking point about the whole affair is that until Galileo forced the issue into the realm of theology, the church had been willing ombudsman for the new astronomy. It had encouraged the work of Copernicus and sheltered Kepler against the persecutions of Calvinists. Problems arose when the debate went beyond the mere question of celestial mechanics, end of quote. Then he goes on to provide some historical background to prove this point. Johnson has written some really great books defending the Catholic Church. I think he teaches at Penn State University. And he had one book, it's entitled The Last Acceptable Prejudice or something like that, Anti-Catholicism,
okay.
Subtitled. I believe he's the one that wrote that book.
Well, Ron, since the topic is so important in defending the church against its enemies through history, give us a brief outline of the historical facts about Galileo and the church.
Johnson tells us that the modern age of science began, around 1543 when Nicholas Copernicus, who happened to be a Polish canon,
meaning a priest?
That's been debated, whether he actually was a priest or whether he was a monk or a brother or not.
But okay.
I read both in different sources, and I did spend a little bit of time trying to nail it down precisely, but I never could come up with a definitive answer.
All right.
But he was a cleric of some kind.
Okay.
And he had a clerical position, although he didn't do priestly duties.
Okay.
His duties were more administrative. And in some diocese in Poland where he lived.
Okay.
But he published this famous book in English on the revolution of the celestial orbs. In Latin, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, in Latin. Although Copernicus, it's known mostly by the name of De Revolutionibus. When I studied history at the University of Illinois in graduate school for quite a few years, came across De Revolutionibus many times.
Really?
In various courses. Well, science, the history of science and its relationship to religion, especially in the 17th to 18th centuries, was my specialty at that time.
And where was this you were studying?
At the University of Illinois.
Okay.
Champaign-Urbana. Although Copernicus held the position of canon for many years, his duties were financial rather than priestly, as I suggested a while ago. The popular view is that Copernicus, quote, discovered, end of quote, that the Earth and other planets revolve around the Sun, the so-called heliocentric model, the Sun, helio, centric, in which the Sun is considered to be the center of the universe. Prior to that, the predominant view was the geocentric or the Ptolemaic model of the universe, in which the Earth is considered the center of the universe, and other objects, including the Sun, go around it. Actually, the heliocentric idea is at least as old as the ancient Greeks. But the ancient philosopher Aristotle, on the other hand, he held the geocentric theory, and Claudius Ptolemy, he was an Egyptian, provided it with mathematical plausibility, just as Copernicus provided a fully predictive mathematical model of a heliocentric system, which was later elaborated and expanded by Johannes Kepler, another very famous astronomer of that period.
Was he Catholic?
Kepler, that I'm not sure. I know he had a lot of trouble with the Protestants, and the Catholic Church defended him at times, but I can't really say for sure about
he
Kepler.
He had trouble with Calvinists?
Yes, Protestants, in other words, at the time, Reformed Protestants at the time.
Okay.
Moreover, certain passages of the Bible seem to affirm the mobility of the sun and the fixity of the earth. Most early church fathers simply took the geocentric hypothesis for granted, but they weren't really very interested in scientific explanations of the cosmos in the first place. As St. Ambrose wrote, quote, "To discuss the nature and position of the earth does not help us in our hope of the life to come," end of quote.
And how about Cardinal Baronius's famous statement, the Bible is to teach us not how the heavens go, but how to go to heaven?
Yes, and originally St. Augustine had said that.
So, oh, really?
So I found that out in some of my research.
Wonderful.
And Baronius was just simply quoting St. Augustine.
Well, in case of doubt, say Augustine said it.
Yeah.
Okay, why was the church interested in astronomy in the first place?
Well, that's a fairly complicated story, but in brief, the church was interested in the movement of the heavenly bodies to ascertain the exact day of Easter. The First Council of Nicaea established the date of Easter in 325 as the first Sunday after the full moon following the vernal equinox. I didn't realize that the council, I knew quite a bit about the Council of Nicaea in 325. Of course, that's the Nicene Creed comes, at least began from that particular council. But I never realized that that also was when they established
the first Sunday after the first full moon after March the 21st?
Yes, the vernal equinox. The old Julian calendar, named after Julius Caesar and promulgated in 46 BC, was in effect at the time, of course. It gained a day, though, about every 134 years. And by 1582, it was 10 days out of alignment with where it supposedly was in 325. So in 1582, that year, Pope Gregory VIII promulgated the Gregorian calendar, which is still in effect in most of the world today. Reform was required because too many leap days had been added with respect to the astronomical seasons on the Julian calendar, because it was off. And on average, the astronomical solstices and equinoxes advanced by 11 minutes per year against the Julian calendar. And as a result, the calculated date of Easter gradually moved out of phase with the March equinox. And the church was satisfied with the geocentric model because it appeared to account accurately enough for its purposes and didn't appear to contradict Scripture. Moreover, it was the least mathematically complicated. In other words, the geocentric theory was a lot less mathematically complicated than was the heliocentric theory. I mean, people like Copernicus and people like Galileo, when they deal with things like this, they deal with it at a mathematical level. Just like, you know, astronomers and cosmologists and all those kinds of scientists do today. You know, I took a course at the University of, several courses at the University of Missouri many years ago, and the professor who I was taking in this one course, who was a world-renowned scholar in his field, he says, you know, there's three circuses in scholarship. It's like a three-ring circus. He said, the first ring is that it's verbal. In other words, you describe something in words. The second ring, it gets a little more complicated, is pictorial. You depict things in graphs and charts and things like that. And then the third ring is mathematical. And he said, what we're going to do in this course and all the courses you're going to be taking here this summer is learn the mathematics. So it happened to be some courses in economics at the time, which is a very difficult subject. And none of us in this group of about 50 college professors who was taking this course, these courses, about six courses that summer on a grant, because we all taught in small colleges, and that sometimes some of us might be called upon to teach some economic courses if we'd had some work in it. And I'd had five or six, seven courses in it, something like that. So I got chosen by my college to go for this program, and so that's why the whole thing
wonderful
came out. So, you know, scientists, they deal in the realm of mathematics, of course, and they've been doing that essentially since the time of the Greeks, since the time of Plato. Well, one scholar has said in regard to this matter, quote, the point was to give order to complicated data, and all that mattered was which hypothesis, a key word in Galileo's affair, was the simplest and the most convenient, end of quote.
Okay, we're down to about 4.5 minutes, so let's go back to our story. How did the church receive Copernicus's heliocentric, or the earth going around the sun, hypothesis?
Well, I read in several places that the church cared very little, as such, for scientific theories. What really mattered to it was how to get to heaven, as we quoted a while ago, what you quoted a while ago, and not so much how the heavens go. As one scholar has said in this regard, quote, astronomy and mathematics were regarded as the playthings of virtuosi. They were accounted as having neither philosophical nor theological relevance, end of quote. And to show how little importance the church placed on the issue at the time, Copernicus published his famous book on the revolution of the celestial orbs, known as De Revolutionibus in Latin, with the blessing of two eminent cardinals and dedicated to Pope Paul III,
okay,
who received it cordially. Copernicus believed the heliocentric model best accounted for the facts that he had observed. He didn't have a telescope. He had to use much more simpler types of techniques in observing the planets and the sun and what have you. In other words, he believed that it was more than a hypothesis. Copernicus believed that it was more than a hypothesis, or that's an educated guess. It was more than an educated guess, what his conclusions were. He worked it out mathematically, you see. And mathematics, logically, is pretty tight. He's able to get by with promoting a new model of the universe by employing Ptolemy's circles and epicycles to explain the orbits of the sun and planets around the Earth, and by borrowing Aristotle's notion that the planets must move in circles because that is the only perfect form of motion. And perhaps the thing that saved his work from church censure at the time was the famous preface by Osiander, a Protestant, who oversaw the printing of the first edition in France, in which he presented the hypothesis, quote, as a mere mathematical device for charting the movements of the planets in a simple manner than the burdensome Ptolemaic system, one that was not meant to be definitive description of the heavens, which everyone took to be Copernicus's, end of quote. Well, it wouldn't have mattered too much to Copernicus anyway, because he was on his deathbed when the book came out in 1543, and so obviously he wasn't murdered. In spite of Brown's claim in Angels and Demons that Copernicus was murdered by the church for his ideas, he died peacefully in bed. His idea about the sun being the center of the universe or solar system sparked what historians have called the Copernicus Revolution.
Ron, many thanks. Our time has run out. We're concluding on Decoding Angels and Demons. Till the next time, may God bless you all, always and in always.